Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday. Joining us with analysis, Wayne Moyer, professor of political science, also department chair of policy studies at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Jim McCormick with us from Iowa State University, where he's a professor of political science in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We're into it, but yes, it is fading in our rearview mirror, but it is still in our minds. Let's talk a little bit about politics today, of course. Later in the program, new developments related to the Russia investigation, bound to be as big a story in 2019 as it was in 2018. Some confusion over a new U.S. strategy for the war in Syria. We'll talk about that as well. And gentlemen, this just in, within the last hour or so, we'll have you comment on the fact that Iowa Representative Steve King is facing a primary challenger for 2020. State Senator Randy Feenstra has announced he'll be challenging Steve King. So that's an interesting development for our 4th District race in 2020. Of course, House of Representatives representatives there elected or reelected every 2 years. Of course, we want to talk about the presidential address last night. It was a direct appeal to the American people. In his first primetime address from the Oval Office, the president portrayed the situation at the Mexican border as a humanitarian crisis. This is the latest chapter, escalation, you might say, in a dispute that has led to a partial government shutdown, now in day 19. Democratic leaders, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senator and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, then gave their own televised address. They criticized the president for asking taxpayers to pay for a wall he had long said Mexico would fund. We want to be talking about this. We want to have you join our discussion. Did you watch the address and the responses from the Democrats yesterday? Did anything change your mind? What are your thoughts? What are your questions about the way forward with the wall? Oh, and the government shutdown. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's listen to the start of the president's address last night. First primetime Oval Office address yesterday evening.
My fellow Americans, tonight I am speaking to you because there is a growing humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border. Every day, Customs and Border Patrol agents encounter thousands of illegal immigrants trying to enter our country. We are out of space to hold them, and we have no way to promptly return them back home to their country. America proudly welcomes millions of lawful immigrants who enrich our society and contribute to our nation. But all Americans are hurt by uncontrolled illegal migration.
So, Jim, we'll start with you. How well did the president make his case for a growing humanitarian and security crisis?
Well, I don't think he really changed very many minds with his presentation. What struck me was that he did try to frame it as a policy issue in terms of both humanitarian crisis and a national security crisis. And I did note that it was really very, very much towards the end of the presentation in which he even mentioned the wall or the barrier here. So he really tried to frame it as a policy issue. I mean, on the other hand, it seems to me what struck me was that the response that Speaker Pelosi and Minority Leader Schumer were really saying was much more in what I would say was kind of a traditional Trump approach of taking on the president personally. I mean, Pelosi started out by talking about that what you have heard is malice and misinformation, and mm-hmm. Schumer talked about that, you know, he's playing on fears and disunity or lack of unity here, division within the country. So I thought there was really a difference in the terms of the style and kind of a reverse of form because, you know, usually the congressional people try to talk about it in terms of policy, and the president has often, you know, used these kind of personal kind of attacks. And I thought the two presentations were kind of a reversal of that. Both of them, in different ways, of course, were speaking to their base. And that's why I see this is not what Lyndon Johnson might say of let's come and reason together, because there was no reasoning together that came out of these two presentations.
Mm-hmm. What struck me, and you touched on it here, Jim, is when you take this, and we do see occasionally see the tightly scripted President Trump, which we saw last night. If you put this type of speech, these utterances next to when he is really in front of his base at a rally, there is, you might not think it's the same person.
That's right. I mean, I think there was really a difference in terms of style and even in terms of cadence here that he presented from the Oval Office.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, what about the president making his case last night? How did you receive it?
I guess I pretty much agree with Jim. I didn't see, I do agree with the change in the president's presentation, but I didn't see much change in either the president's position or the position of Pelosi and Schumer. One possibility that sort of did come to me in terms of the president's presentation, at least, is on the humanitarian side of things. There, if that could be emphasized as opposed to the wall, and there was a little of that last night, then that conceivably could be the basis of some kind of agreement, although I'm doubtful whether the president's able to move right now, or for that matter, whether the Democrat leaders in Congress are able to move.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you think that, Wayne? Why the sort of stuck here? Why are we stuck?
I think for both, in both cases, it's appealing to their bases. I think Trump still thinks that what worked in 2016 will work for him today in terms of holding his base and conceivably building it. And the Democrats are operating on the basis of the 2018 election, which gave them 40 new seats in the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, talking on this Politics Day, initially about the president's address, the Democratic leaders' responses yesterday. We'll hear more of that audio in just a moment. Let's go to our phones. Brian is with us in Clinton. Hi, Brian. How did you take in the address?
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. You know, I'm an independent voter, and I can see the points by both sides, but to me, Trump has ruined his credibility to appeal to anybody at this point, even if what he says is reasonable. He's become an unreasonable man to me. So I feel like if General Mattis or somebody that was his mouthpiece, now that he's gone, that's impossible. But if General Mattis were out there saying, hey, we need a wall, I think that more independents and maybe even some Democrats would say, okay, we need to really think seriously about this.
Mm-hmm.
But with Trump being the mouthpiece, I think he's just ruined his ability to appeal to anybody that isn't his core base.
Brian and Clinton, thank you for that. What about that? Of course, all the major media outlets, including NPR, really armed with their fact-checking systems there, Jim. We know from this president that fact-checking is not only in order, but much in demand when he speaks. Take the instance of the NPR checking whether the statement that there is a growing humanitarian and security crisis on our southern border. NPR pointing out that illegal border crossings in the most recent fiscal year ending in September of 2018 were actually lower than either 2016 or 2014, and much lower than at their peak around 2000. Jim, what about Brian's point there that this president is perhaps seen differently when he makes an appeal for this kind of crisis from the Oval Office compared to other presidents?
I think so, because, you know, most of the opinions about President Trump are sort of already baked in very much into the system. And it was sort of revealing that caller noted that he was an independent voter, but so even some of the independents have kind of put into their system already how they view and what kind of credibility they give to the president. And that's why, you know, the idea of turning the page and trying to move in a different direction is going to be so difficult for the president here. I mean, it's the same way on the other side, as sort of Wayne alluded to, that, you know, the Democrats are really appealing to their base. And there's no way that, given all these new members in Congress, and particularly some of them that are very, very vocal, in terms of their views about the president, that she's going to move away from anything that would be look at accommodation. And, of course, she's already baked in some views herself, saying that at most she'd give a dollar to a wall, and she has called it immoral and so on. So, you know, we have this, unfortunately, this, you know, very intractable kind of division between between our two leaders here. One of the things I haven't, and maybe Wayne or Ben could, you could enter this, I haven't seen any numbers on how many people actually viewed the speeches last night. I think that might be revealing as well, because I suspect that some people have just sort of been so turned off by this sort of, you know, this kind of back and forth here, that they probably did not even give either side a chance to make their case to them.
I have not seen those figures. Perhaps we can share those with you a little later as we do a little research. Join our conversation with Jim McCormick, Wayne Moyer, political scientists, Jim at Iowa State University, Wayne at Grinnell College, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Reggie in Oskaloosa. Reggie, did you watch the address and the Democratic response last night?
Yes, I watched both. What I saw was, you know, the president, though I don't always agree with, but sometimes, laid out specific things that were problems at the border, specific things that needed to be fixed, and Pelosi and Schumer came out and just basically threw out insults and talking points and gave no ideas of how to fix anything. As somebody who spent a lot of time on guard duty, I can tell you that walls actually are effective. You know, no matter what Nancy Pelosi says, and the fact that she calls them immoral, even though she has one around her mansion in a sanctuary city, just reeks of hypocrisy mm-hmm. to me.
Okay, Reggie and Oskaloosa, thank you very much. Certainly there were those words that you mentioned from the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, but she was not lacking in suggestions. In fact, we have a bit of audio there. She insisted that Democrats agreed we need to secure our borders. Here are some of the suggestions she laid out.
We can build the infrastructure and roads at our ports of entry. We can install new technology to scan cars and trucks for drugs coming into our nation. We can hire the personnel we need to facilitate trade and immigration at the border. We can fund more innovation to detect unauthorized crossings. The fact is, the women and children at the border are not a security threat. They are a humanitarian challenge, a challenge that President Trump's own cruel and counterproductive policies have only deepened.
Okay. Wayne, comment on that, because, I mean, we have to bring out, and it's been brought out in recent days in the analysis, we're conflating two things here. We do have a crisis of sorts with asylum seekers on our southern border, don't we?
We have more women and children applying for immigration or asylum. We have fewer overall applications per people coming in. And, of course, women and children create special problems, and they get a lot of publicity. But overall, the pressures on the border are less than they were 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's hear from the minority leader in the Democratic Party's response to the president's address. Both Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer requested that the president separate the shutdown from arguments over border security.
There is bipartisan legislation supported by Democrats and Republicans to reopen government while allowing debate over border security to continue. There is no excuse for hurting millions of Americans over a policy difference. Federal workers are about to miss a paycheck. Some families can't get a mortgage to buy a new home. Farmers and small businesses won't get loans they desperately need. Most presidents have used Oval Office addresses for noble purposes. This president just used the backdrop of the Oval Office to manufacture a crisis, stoke fear, and divert attention from the turmoil in his administration.
Jim, what about this point that Minority Leader Schumer brought up, that there is bipartisan legislation supported by both Democrats and Republicans? How does that look at this point?
Well, there is that legislation. Of course, the House of Representatives even last week immediately sort of passed those separate bills, I think six separate bills of in sort of funding the government, opening it, and sort of put the ball into the court of the Senate, and where the Senate Majority Leader said he won't take it up unless President Trump, supports those measures, which he has not. The other part of this, of course, which Senator Schumer didn't mention, is that there's a history on both Speaker Pelosi and of Senator Schumer authorizing funding for a border wall.
Right,
and that was sort of left out of the debate. I mean, the president
mentioned it, right?
He mentioned it, but you know, so here we have these two sides really talking past one another, and you know, maybe that's the genesis of some sort of a compromise here. I mean, I think it's going to take more than that. That recognizing that there are both of these pieces of legislation, I think you'll have to throw in some goodies for both sides here, so they can both come out and claim victory. But each of these sides have really different goals. I don't know if we'll get to sort of possible outcomes, but
yeah, let's go there because you say goodies for each side. Are the Democrats in a position? Do they need to hand out goodies? Do you think?
Well, the Democrats, I think the strategy right now is really to peel off Republican senators and to do what Senator Schumer suggested, just to vote on the legislation that was previously passed by the House. And they already have public opinion on their side, so there's not too much incentive to give very much up. On the Republican side, I did hear that Senator Graham is trying to put together a package of pieces of legislation, and maybe including DACA, some resolution of the DACA issue that goes back to at least 2013 here, and President Obama, who used an executive order to give some extended time. So that might be part of the kind of the package that could be brought together, and maybe they can fuzzy it up enough so that the funding here, that the president would have some discretion of whether he could use the funding for some sort of a border wall, and not call it a border wall, call it something else. I mean, that's the only kind of, as I was thinking about this, the only, at least on the face of it at the present time, given the great gulf here, that they might pursue. But Wayne probably's got a better idea than that.
One thing that strikes me, there already is at least a fence over something like 600 or 700 miles of the border, and conceivably a final solution might mean strengthening some of the existing fences. One of the problems is a good part of where there isn't a wall is along the Rio Grande River in Texas. And do you want to put a wall up right along the river when half of the river itself is U.S. territory? So, the other thing that troubles me about all of this, border security and the wall are not the same thing.
Yeah.
The wall conceivably is a part of border security, but I think most people argue that it's not the major element in terms of preserving border security.
Right. The number of unauthorized border crossers are dwarfed by the number of people who overstay their visas, for example.
I mean, yes. It seems to me there's really certain sections might be amenable to a wall, as Wayne was suggesting here. But in terms of the entirety, as at least candidate Trump talked about, a 1,000-mile wall and all of that sort of thing, that's probably not necessary and certainly doesn't engender very much support across the country.
Let's get a couple of callers in before we have to go to break. Tom is with us in Des Moines. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Tom, coming up on a break, we're sure glad to have you with us from Des Moines.
Yes, thank you. Just to piggyback on the last point, I think the debate over the wall is really over. We've built, 500 or 700 miles of wall, and we don't need any more wall. I think that's the center of American politics right now. Trump has insisted that the border security is the wall, and so he's made this into a national crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But we all understand that that's not the case. So I want to ask your commentators there, do they think the real crisis is the wall, or is the real crisis the government shutdown?
Okay, very good. Thanks, Tom in Des Moines. Jim, let's go to you.
Well, clearly, who you talk to will answer that question. I mean, I think clearly both sides have you know, sort of staked out their positions here. So, you know, you're going to get really, really different answers here.
Okay. Let's go to Mike in Independence. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead. We're short on time, but please make your point.
I'd like to know why our senators, Grassley and Ernst, are not taking a proactive step for the government workers, where obviously the arguments have been debunked, everything he's put out. Mm-hmm. So now it's simply the crisis, as stated by the last person, is the crisis is the shutdown.
All right, okay.
Why aren't our two senators stepping up?
Okay, I think this does put perhaps our GOP senators, both of them Republicans, in an uneasy situation. Does it not, Wayne Moyer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very difficult. I think Senator Grassley made a comment the other day that he hopes this thing can be resolved, and he thinks it's possible to resolve it. But I think it's very difficult, as long as Trump's base is behind him, for the senators to really differ greatly from the president.
And Joni Ernst up for re-election in 2020. That has to be on her mind with this, Jim, even though 2020 is...
Absolutely. I was just about to mention that. I mean, she's got to really be careful here in terms of sort of the upcoming campaign and, you know, where Trump would stand on this, and even supporters and within Iowa that are Trump supporters and her reelection bid. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you spoke of Senator Grassley. He says he's confident that a compromise on immigration can be found to end the partial federal government shutdown. He also says that if the president declares a national emergency, the action would likely wind up in court.
He thinks he has the power. I think if he exercises that power, it's going to be challenged in the court, and we're going to have to respect what the court has done.
Okay. Now, the president has said he might declare an emergency on the southern border in the walk up to this address last night in order to get the wall funding he wants without congressional approval. I guess we'll talk about that when we come back in just a moment as we do some cleanup here on our discussion of the address last night and the Democratic response. So much else to get to on this Politics Wednesday with Jim McCormick, political science professor at Iowa State University, and Wayne Moyer, professor of political science at Grinnell College. We'd like to have you join our discussion, whether you want to talk about immigration and the wall, but also we'll be talking about some new developments related to the Russia investigation and confusion over the new U.S. strategy for the war in Syria. Remember, we have about 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria, and not too long ago, the president announced that they would be rapidly withdrawn. We don't know the status of that. I'm going to quiz Wayne and Jim about the consequences of the withdrawal from Syria and our relations with NATO ally Turkey. That's when we continue our discussion on this Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our analysts on board today, talking about the address from the president, his first from the Oval Office last night on the situation at the Mexican border, describing it as a humanitarian crisis. Democratic leaders, Speaker Pelosi and Minority Leader Schumer giving their own criticisms of the president's actions, saying he's asking taxpayers to pay for a wall he had long said Mexico would fund. We want to finish up this discussion. We have a lot of people who want to get in on it, but we do have so many other important aspects of politics to discuss within the last few days. But let's go to Steve in Des Moines. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Hi. I'm not sure if this is possible. I'm not sure rules would prevent it. There's some rule I'm not aware of, but I don't understand why Congress doesn't step up and do their job. You know, they could pass a budget, I believe, with a veto-proof majority, and then they wouldn't need the president's signature. The government would be funded, and this created crisis would be over. The problem is it's going to take an awful lot of political will on the part of the Republican half of the houses and the Senate to even come close to getting that done.
Right. Steve, and isn't it true, Wayne, that there's one particular figure, Mitch McConnell, standing in the way of such an action? Should there be?
Yeah, it's Mitch McConnell. And I think the other problem is that for Republicans to break at this stage, given the strength of support that Trump still has, brings the risk of a primary challenge for many of the Republicans, senators and members of the House in 2020, the senators who are up for re-election. And I think they're very hesitant to go that route to try to put together a veto-proof majority.
Mm-hmm. So we mentioned the first presidential address by this president from the Oval Office last night. Jim, you asked earlier about how many people watched it. Well, Emily Woodbury, our producer, has been researching that. Complete ratings for the speech and response available later today, but preliminary figures reported by the Hollywood Reporter show that the quarter hour containing the president's speech was watched by 28.1% of TV households. The following 15 minutes, including the analysis, and the Pelosi-Schumer rebuttal, averaged 29.3% of households across major networks. So that's a little bit to answer your question. Jim, let me fire this off at you before we move on. A lot of talk in recent days, though, and we were expecting perhaps the president would announce it last night to declare this emergency and bypass Congress. Do you still see that as a possibility we should be keeping a watch on?
I think it's a possibility, but I'm very doubtful that he would do that. I mean, because again, as was pointed out, it would lead to sort of legal action and even extending this even further here. Now, it is the case, though, that you know I'm not sure how many of our listeners are aware of this, that you know presidents have really used these emergency powers rather consistently. I was looking at some figures on the use of what's called the National Emergency Act that was passed in 1976, there have been at least 31 instances of its use by presidents since then, which is which really kind of surprised me in terms of the number of usages. Some of them have been in terms of imposing some sanctions, say, on Ukraine or on other countries, Iraq and Iran and so on. So there's a wide berth that presidents can use, and they have been used rather generously, if you think of it in terms of these 31 different instances here.
Okay. Plenty to discuss with the immigration as an issue, the border wall, the government shutdown. We're going to move on, though, in the final minutes of this hour to talk a little bit about the Russia investigation, first of all. Paul Manafort accused of giving data to a Russian, the president's former campaign manager, sharing polling data during the 2016 presidential campaign with an associate tied to Russian intelligence. This according to a court filing unsealed yesterday. Wayne, what did you make of this?
Well, I think this strengthens the argument that there may well have been collusion between the Trump campaign and officials that are linked to the Kremlin. That's where the question has been all along. Was there direct collusion between the Russians and the Americans? And Trump has denied that. But this Manafort question is making that more difficult. It's more difficult to say there wasn't.
Evidently, evidence that the Trump campaign may have tried to coordinate with the Russians, but nothing to date tying it to the president, right, Jim?
Yes, that's right. And I'm just wondering, in terms of what actually happened with the polling data. I mean, it's interesting in and of itself. You know, there's a lot of polls and so on. So I guess the other question I would have is, has the Mueller investigation got some information that says that with that polling data that this proceeded to have the Russians take some action or some kind of cooperative behavior between the two? So just on the face of it, it's interesting that they're and maybe that's a direction, but I think you need some more evidence to sort of make a conclusion about any collusion.
Right, and polling data can be public data or it can be private data. So
it could really be. I assume that this is, although I'm not. This is probably internal polls that that the campaign had, given that Manafort was the campaign manager. You know, which are usually not made publicly available. Although by some of those investigative reporters, they might be able to get access to some of this, this is information.
Also related to the Russia probe, Natalia Veselnitskaya. This is the Russian lawyer who met with the Trump campaign officials at the Trump Tower in the summer of 2016, charged this week in New York on a separate case, but a case that shows her deep ties to the Kremlin. Also reports today that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, planning to leave the Justice Department shortly after William Barr, the president's nominee for attorney general, is confirmed. Now, we have to remind ourselves that Deputy Attorney General has been managing this special counsel, Robert Mueller's Russia investigation, and has signaled to other officials he would leave when satisfied that the Mueller investigation with eyes are complete or close enough to completion that it was protected. What does this tell you, Wayne, about where we are in the Russia investigation, these nuggets of new information?
Well, clearly, Mueller is still going, and he's gotten the grand jury extension, I think, for another 6 months. So he's still digging in. I think if Rosenstein leaves, then that raises an interesting question with the new attorney general, Barr, if he's confirmed, having previously criticized the investigation. Will he directly then try to rein in Mueller? I think it's going to be extremely difficult because I think the investigation's gone far enough. And I think Congress is beginning to re-examine the issue of trying to protect Mueller's position. There's some noises in the Senate of legislation to protect his position. So I'm not quite sure where it's going, but it's still going ahead full speed.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears and go to Syria. A new year, bringing apparently a new U.S. strategy from the president for the war in Syria. But we're not really sure about that. Let's talk about the latest developments in that region against the backdrop of President Trump's surprise announcement last month that the Islamic State militant group had been defeated in Syria, and also that U.S. troops in the country numbering around 2,000 would be coming home. Now, speaking on Sunday during a visit to Israel, the National Security Advisor John Bolton outlined conditions for U.S. troop departure from Syria, but it appears to contradict President Trump's insistence that the withdrawal be immediate and without conditions.
Right on your border, we have the problem of the conflict in Syria. We're going to be discussing the president's decision to withdraw, but to do so from northeast Syria in a way that makes sure that ISIS is defeated and is not able to revive itself and become a threat again, and to make sure that the defense of Israel and our other friends in the region is absolutely assured, and to take care of those who have fought with us against ISIS and other terrorist groups.
Okay, John Bolton this past Sunday adding also the U.S. would only pull out of Syria if Turkey pledged not to attack its Kurdish allies there. Though yesterday, the Turkish president, Erdogan announced comments from Bolton that Turkey must agree to protect Kurds if it withdraws Americans from Syria. Bolton, he denounced those, the Turkish president, was denied a meeting, right, Wayne? A meeting with the Turkish president, denied a meeting, our national security advisor.
That's correct. I think we've got caught between our alliance with Turkey and our alliance with Israel. And Israel, I think, is very concerned with the American troops pull out of Syria, that increases the ability of Iran to move weapons and all through Syria close to Israel. Turkey, on the other hand, is worried about the Kurds, who are linked with a Kurdish insurgency inside of Turkey. And I don't think that we have fully resolved where we want to go with this at this stage.
Mm-hmm. Given what's happened in the past few weeks, Jim, do you see a resolution that appears?
Well, I think the Americans have really step back from what the Trump administration announced. I mean, I think Bolton's statement really is a statement of policy right now. Apparently, the origins of this, you might remember a few months back, the president said we'd be leaving Syria very soon, was the actual quote, I think. And then, of course, in December, late December, or December 21st, he suddenly announced that we're going to pull out. And this was apparently after a conversation with the Turkish president here. And it seems to me, at least what I read into this, it was this kind of snap decision once again on foreign policy, mm-hmm. without consulting some of his aides and sort of thinking about the larger impact that it would have on the region and on American policy. And of course, one of the immediate effects was that the defense secretary stepped down here, Jim Mattis, as well. Now, that may have been in the works in any event, but this was sort of the event, it seemed, that sparked this. And even the special representative for policy in the region there announced that he was leaving, U.S. representative, special representative, announced that he was leaving. So I think this is really, again, that policy was not really very well coordinated among advisors by the president here, and instead was this kind of snap decision. And now, if you will, sort of cooler heads are considering sort of the impact of what actions the president was proposing.
Let's talk in the final minutes a little bit about the start of primary caucus season, less than 13 months before, what is it, February 3rd, 2020 is the caucus here. Sorry to fast forward into the future here, but the candidates are already there. The most high-profile one of them appearing in Des Moines last Friday, Senator Elizabeth Warren held a kickoff campaign event in Iowa as she begins her 2020 presidential campaign.
So right now, government works great for giant drug companies. It just doesn't work for people trying to fill prescriptions. It works great for giant oil companies that want to drill everywhere. It just doesn't work for families that want kids who can actually breathe the air. It works great for giant financial companies like Equifax. It just doesn't work for people whose Social Security numbers get stolen. That's the difference in America. It is an America right now that works for the rich and the powerful. And we need to call that out for what it is. Corruption, pure and simple.
Elizabeth Warren, a senator from Massachusetts, speaking in Des Moines last Friday. So obviously a populist, progressive message there. Jim, what do you see foresee in the battle, the primary battle among the Democratic contenders?
Well, it's going to be a very large set of candidates that we're going to see. And there's going to be some of the sort of this populist message, this sort of, you know, as Trump was engaged in a populist kind of campaign against government, you know, what Elizabeth Warren was talking about was against American corporations here and American business and their capturing of this government. So it's a kind of an interesting kind of twist here. But you also had, even within the past few days, former Vice President Biden announced that he was really the one that could really take on Trump. And I fully expect that he will jump into the race. And you'll have these candidates from different wings of the Democratic Party. And there's, you know, the speculation is there may be up to 20 of these different right. candidates that might vie for the nomination here. And they'll be across, I think, the political spectrum. So Elizabeth Warren represents sort of one sort of end of that spectrum. And I suspect that Vice President Biden is probably going to represent sort of the other end of that.
Mm-hmm. And we know, I think, from polling that foremost or near foremost among Democratic Party voters is just win the White
That's
House.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just win. Electability is near the top or at the very top. We also have this new wild card as of the midterms, this Beto O'Rourke from Texas. He is the Texan representative a loser, but still being talked about quite a bit, came within 3 points of defeating Ted Cruz in this strongly Republican state, an astonishing fundraiser for the party, and has attracted the attention, I think, of some perhaps even former President Obama and some of his former operatives. So, Wayne, what are your thoughts on our Democratic primary season?
Strikes me, if we look at this last congressional election in the House, there were a few very, very liberal people that were elected that are getting a lot of publicity. But if you look at most of the Democrats that took Republican seats, they're moderates. And I'm wondering whether the American people and whether the Iowa citizens in the caucuses will be looking for someone who is on the left or someone sort of to calm the country down after 4 years of Donald Trump?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I think competence is really going to be the issue in 2020, as well as electability. I mean, you're right, that electability. And I think, you know, Wayne has really, really hit on it, that there are these liberal members that were elected who've been getting a lot of publicity, even in the past few days, for their language and statements and so on. But I think there are going to be other members who really want to be able to have some successes that they can run on in 2020.
Mm-hmm. When you say competence, Jim, do you mean sort of experience, that it's not likely we're going to get another outsider to face the outsider, previous outsider, who was up to that point
elected office? I think competence really means some experience here in the governing process.
Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders, a huge name in our last caucuses. What about Bernie this time around? Certainly can be compared with Elizabeth Warren there in the types of issues that they are pushing. Right, Wayne?
Yeah, I think there is a question of whether he'll be able to mobilize the same constituency that he was able to mobilize the last time. And there will be other people like Elizabeth Warren who are competing for that same constituency. And he's 4 years older. I think he's now 78. And I really wonder whether he can do it again.
Mm-hmm. When we look back at 2018 and look at the politics that may carry on into the next year, I don't know what your thoughts are on the political events of the past year that really are likely to shape our future here politically, pointing to one here that in our midterm we had a 100-year high in turnout for the midterm election. Over 50%, according to the U.S. Election Project at the University of Florida, that we have to go back to 1914 to find a midterm that had higher election turnout. Jim, what does this tell you? Is a blip, or do you think we're ramping up to have more people engaged?
Well, there clearly were, you know, in terms of the number of women candidates, for example, the number of women candidates that won, that certainly I think stimulated the base in terms of getting women out to vote and to participate. And so I don't think that is likely to falter in any way. I think the wild card remains, it seems to me, is in terms of young voters, in terms of how they will they be mobilized to turn out. But the 50% number is really, really quite remarkable. Those are generally in presidential elections. You know, usually congressional elections are in the 35% to 40% turnout categories here, at least in the American setting here. So that'll be interesting to see if it can be maintained here. But it will be the result, I think, that you still have, you know, there are people that are really motivated by the Trump administration and reaction to them, either on one side or the other. And so that I think it's possible to keep some motivation here.
Mm-hmm. More women than ever, as you mentioned, 127 serving in this present Congress, but not bipartisan in terms of the women, 106 of the 127 Democrats. Before we go, Wayne Moyer, what do you think of this faction of progressives in among the House Democrats? Is that going to present problems to the Democrats, the leadership, like the Tea Party of the left, so to speak?
Possibly. But Nancy Pelosi has been very effective up until now. in terms of controlling the Democrats, and I suspect that she will continue to be effective. The other thing I think is important here, and
quickly,
is that
Wayne,
most of these women who are elected, I think, are moderates.
Okay.
And moderate, just a little left of center or centrist. And I think it's only a small minority that are on the far left side.
And you can count on the fact that we'll certainly be looking to interview both Cindy Axne and Representative Abby Finkenauer, our two new members of Congress here in Iowa. When we can get their voices on this program, we will. Jim McCormick, Wayne Moyer, thank you so much for joining us on this edition of Politics Wednesday.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.